You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Chris Riddell is a world-renowned illustrator and author of children's books, and is also the political cartoonist for The Observer. He has collaborated with artists such as Neil Gaiman, Phoebe Bridges, and Frances Harding. In 2018, he travelled to Aotearoa to speak at the Auckland Writers' Festival. Most recently, Chris released I Can't Remember What We Talked About, a slim volume of 24 short poems. Chris and Beth had a chat about designing pop-up book sets for Phoebe Bridges' Punisher Tour, the importance of a connection to nature, the creative process of art making, and magical pear tree staffs. They also talked about what it's like being a political cartoonist in the current political climate. Here's that interview.
So, yeah, I mean, Beth, I was going to read you just a few poems, I think, maybe. And you know, part of me, you know, hesitates to say they're poems. You know, it's one of those things, you know, a lyric is a lyric because it's got music and songs to it. Poetry is a certain thing. And I know many poets and they have a, you know, wonderful dexterity with language. My favourite poet is William Carlos Williams, who was a turn of the century, an American poet. And what I loved about his style is it's, I think he's called an imagist, but he actually is sort of not poetic in the accepted sense, but he leaves these big spaces, these gaps to for you to wonder why the red wheelbarrow was left out in the rain, you know, what is the significance of those white chickens? You know, what was that big row he had with his wife about those plums in the icebox? You know, that sort of...
I love that one.
So in some sense, this is me channeling that spirit. They're fairly autobiographical and tend to be little snippets of things. And this one I wrote because I worked with this wonderful man called Spike, who does the sets and things at the Troubadour in LA. And he was working with Phoebe on her tour, designing the lighting and the... And I met him the year before when I drew for Phoebe at a couple of her shows. And so we had this, during lockdown, this extraordinary relationship where I would sort of phone up LA and talk to Spike, and he would talk to me about sort of doing the stage settings for the upcoming tour, which started, I think, as a sort of with no audiences and then became a sort of outdoor tour.
Yeah.
I designed a series of drawings for each of the songs, and we used to do this sort of me talking to Spike in LA, me in rural Norfolk, you know, sort of having these time zone conversations. And then they got a wonderful designer to make this thing into a pop-up book that they projected on behind the show for each song. And a book would open and this thing would pop up, and I go, oh my goodness, I drew that. So it was a sort of, you know, magical thing. And I only saw this on countless fans' mobile phones that they posted on the internet. So I'd sort of be looking over the shoulder at a gig in Nashville, and there would be my burning house turning up, and I'd go, my goodness. And I was really looking forward to going along to the show to actually see it live, you know, and Phoebe had invited me to Brixton where the show was going to be. And that week I caught COVID right at the end of the pandemic. After all that stuff, that was a 1 week I caught COVID, so I couldn't go.
No.
And my youngest son, Jack, he went with his mobile phone and he just filmed little bits of it for me so he could bring it back. So he got all the fun, which I suppose is appropriate, but I missed out. So I wrote this little poem. It's called Brixton Gig for Phoebe Bridges. That skinhead neighbour is in the undergrowth. I enjoy the thought of his prejudice nourishing your garden. Spike and Renee in LA and me at home last summer, making that pop-up book bloom, then close again, like a Bible pressing a flower. I was looking forward to seeing this alchemy for myself, rather than on bobbing YouTube phones. I wanted to be there to draw for Harrison as he sang, I love his mom, and to see Emily play, and Marshall carry the drums, and argue with the evangelicals to see Darren again. But COVID has got me like a dog with a bird in its teeth, so I must stay at home in my garden. It's coming up lavender. And ghost your Brixton gig instead, enjoying the haunted house go up in flames as my son Jack films it on his phone for his faraway father. I never got to see it. Never got to see that show.
That's so disappointing. But at least you got this wonderful poem out of it.
Hey, there is that, Beth, always. This is a little poem. It's called Maker of Marks. It was in late spring. I was sitting in the garden in bright, lovely sunshine. I looked across and the irises in the flower bed had suddenly bloomed. I hadn't even noticed there they were, just looking gorgeous. And then my wife came and sat down next to me and said, and I said, look, the irises are in bloom. And she said, oh, haven't you noticed? And so this came out of that moment. While I wasn't watching, the irises bloomed, splendid now in their bobbing blue bonnets. The blackbird began singing especially loudly from the top of the bay, and the great elm, four gardens away, covered itself in leaves once again. While I wasn't watching, my family grew up, my mother aged, the world turned and turned, while I turned each day to ink and paper and the obsessive making of marks. While I wasn't watching, my wife sat down beside me and followed my gaze. They don't last long, she said. Enjoy them now. So that was my little moment. You know, and it's actually better. You know, I spend all my time drawing. I'm slightly obsessive. It's how I relax after a hard day drawing. The way I relax is to sit down and draw. So I don't know what that's about, but it's a sort of fundamental thing that I do.
Yeah.
I wonder, actually, it must be, if you sort of have grown up with music and singing and songwriting, it must be the same. You know, when are you singing for pleasure? When are you singing as a job? You can quite define it that way.
No, yeah, it's all just expression.
It is, isn't it? Yes, it's expressing yourself, and that's a lovely thing. And this last one is at the very end of the book. I didn't intend it to be at the end of the book, but it was on my birthday. You know, as a man of a certain age, you know, one has these sort of understandable sensitivities, intimations of mortality, you know, and this is called Thursday, the 13th of April. I don't feel old, but my beard is white. My hair is a dome of stubble. And my belly has grown into a pillow for a cat. The mirror tells me daily how far I've come, so I look out of the window instead and wonder how far I have to go. Loss is a companion now, but so is love, fingers entwined in mine and whispering in my ear, go on. So that's me looking out of my window, Beth, which I do often in my street in Brighton. And there is this absolutely joyful moment in the day where I look out on the street and we have a school at the top of the road and we have a kindergarten at the bottom. And at about 3:15, you have this little sort of crocodile of tiny children being led by their after-school attendants in their high-vis, tripping down the street. And so I look out of the window and I see this gorgeous little sight of these tiny children, and they gambol, you know, like lambs. It's extraordinary. You know, that exuberance when you just don't know any better, you know, no cares in the world that we would understand. And it's a joyful thing. And I often think, my goodness, you know, I can't remember that time. All my memories of that are so vague, and yet it's so delightful when you see it. That's a life-affirming moment each day. So that's why I often look out of my window.
Yeah. I mean, even when I look out of my window and I see, like, you know, a tree or something, you just feel instantly just sort of rejuvenated.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I got a relationship with a number of trees, I've got to say, personal relationships.
Yep.
There's a tree four gardens away here in Brighton. I think of it as my lockdown tree. During that, certainly over here, we had that dread time you had of extraordinary lockdown, I know. But over in the UK during lockdown, there was this extraordinary weather where the birds started singing and there were no chemtrails in the sky. There were no sort of aircraft. It was suddenly this weird sort of sense of spring coming. And yet we were so full of doom, you know, this thing of the end of the world. In the bright sunshine, I remember looking across and seeing the elm tree four gardens away, big, dominating the skyline. And it had started to sprout its greenery for spring. And within a sort of week, it was burgeoning. And I remember thinking, my goodness, that's what we want. This is the hope that we're searching for. And then a year later, I remember looking across and seeing it start again, thinking, my goodness, you know, a year's passed and we're still here. We're still sort of waiting for hope. We're waiting for this to sort of... And then just last year, sort of end of last year, I heard a chainsaw going. And I looked up and they were cutting down the elm tree because it had caught Dutch elm, the tree that I'd watched all through lockdown.
Yeah.
I'll read this little poem. This will be the last poem, Beth. I've delighted you enough, I'm sure. But this is called I'm Not Crying. The Grim Reaper came for my lockdown tree this morning. Disease bleaching the canopy that had given me hope in that blighted year. lopped from the top in great falling logs. The chainsaw wielder reduced you to firewood. As I watched, you touched me again. Your sawdust carried on the wind from four gardens away, settling on my clothes and in my eye.
Honestly, there's nothing more devastating than a favorite tree being felled. Yeah, just the connection, I think, to nature is just, like, for me, it's so important.
These extraordinary sort of, you know, trees that we can sort of have relationship. I have two very large oak trees at my house in Norfolk in the woods.
Mm.
They're like two giants. I mean, they're ancient. But I also have a rather intense relationship with an old pear tree that is right next to my cottage. And because pear trees don't last that long. And this one must be, you know, at least 150 years old. And it's got this beautiful canopy. And its pears are tiny little bullets. But it's majestic. And it does what very old fruit trees do. It loses its branches. And sometimes that looks quite dramatic, like a whole bit of the canopy will fall down, a great big branch. And one fell a couple of years ago, and it was just too beautiful because it was actually the shape of what I imagined Gandalf's staff to be. So I took this and I sort of very lovingly sort of sanded it and applied gun oil, the sort of oil you put on the stocks of shooting rifles. And I now have in the corner of my studio in Norfolk a wizard's staff. You know, I'm sure it's got magical properties. I haven't tested it, but it sits there rather magnificently as part of my pear tree.
Mm, you should try it out.
Yes, we who knows? It could have magical properties. I won't hold my breath, but, you know, I also have a flower meadow. There's an avenue of trees through the woods. It's my prized possession. It's sitting in that flower meadow, looking at the Norfolk sky, which is very big because it's Norfolk as a county is quite flat. And we've got the huge skies. So a lot of the landscape is embodied in the clouds and the skies. And a few years ago, a farmer had an old grain silo that had since been decommissioned and was lying on its side. And we said to the farmer, could we buy this silo? Because it means a lot to us. And he said, oh, you can have it. You can get someone to take it away. You can have it. And we managed to sort of put it up into our meadow. I didn't. I got someone who knew what they were doing, who said to me, what sort of livestock are you keeping? And I said, I'm not keeping any livestock. He gave me such a pitying look, this townie who didn't know anything. And we've turned it into a little viewing platform where we put some windows in the front of it and a balcony and staircase, a steel spiral staircase. You can walk up the staircase and then you can go and sit out on the balcony and watch the sunset. Best thing ever. You know, it doesn't serve any other purpose. And I know a lot of our friends look at us as if we're mad. Sunsets are fantastic. I did book called, I re-illustrated the wonderful sort of classic children's book, The Little Prince.
Yeah.
And if you've not read it, Beth, I mean, it's a gorgeous thing. Hugely well-known in Europe and in America, but less well-known in the Anglophone world and certainly less well-known in the UK. And The Little Prince has this thing on his tiny asteroid where he watches endless sunsets. And I wrote this little poem. It's sort of about my flower meadow. It's called Heaven. I see heaven every day through the avenue of trees across the wood slat bridge where the meadow waits. And as the sun sets, like the little prince on his asteroid, I see the beautiful confines of my small world each day. And I've done a little drawing of the little prince.
Oh, there he is.
The little prince is just a gorgeous, very French, very sort of particular in its sort of approach to stuff, but full of poetry and full of sort of rather poetic ideas.
What was the process like of writing your poems? Did you begin by sketching an illustration?
No, I mean, they come to me, Beth, in moments. So they're very autobiographical. There'll be a moment where something just pops into my head and I think, oh, that's a poem and I'll write something down. They don't really start as poems. I mean, possibly like lyrics, you know, they maybe build from a phrase or a cadence, and then they sort of become fully formed because they're very short and very small things.
Mm.
And then the illustration, in a sense, is a way to just give them a sort of setting. And I find when I illustrate poetry, as I find when I illustrate lyrics and songs, is that you can provide maybe a little way in, a little sort of, you know, cue to what the music is doing or what the words are doing, that make the understanding of it a little bit less daunting, particularly in poetry. There can be barriers set up. You know, people go, well, I don't like poetry, and you know, poetry's not for me. But if you can present it in a way where you go, well, I get what this is. Sometimes a picture that wraps itself around the words can do that. And I find when I'm illustrating lyrics, particularly at a gig, live music, and a singer-songwriter like yourself is singing a song, it's often if I'm drawing something, the moment I think that for me almost sort of sets things off is when I can title a song at the end. So I can draw to exactly the time the song takes. So as you finish, I finish the drawing and then I just write the title, the song. Mm. Because as a performer, you're not going to tell people again what the song's called. You know, you've sung the song, it's in the ending. Mm. But it provides the audience with that sort of, you know, aid memoir. They go, oh, well, that's that song. It's called this. It's called Tiny Flowers. Oh, look, there it is, Tiny Flowers. Mm. And so it's a nice unspoken way of reinforcing, I think, the performance. And I think, you know, with the poetry I write, I mean, I keep calling it poetry, but with this sort of thing, I don't think I'll ever write anything else. But if a few things do occur to me, I might. I spend a lot of my time sort of dealing with politics and drawing cartoons for The Observer over here in the UK and publishing my own sort of, you know, political sketches. And that can be grim and angry and full of sort of regret and remorse and all those sort of things. So it's nice sometimes to go somewhere else where you're looking to be hopeful and joyful and poetic.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, but I would like to ask you about what it's like being a political cartoonist in the current political climate. I think you'd have a great time with our recent swing to the right government. It's...
Yeah, of course. My goodness, I've been saying it, Beth, and you've got to pinch yourself sometimes and go, "What? How did we get here? You know, what's happening? We were doing so well, and then suddenly we're swerving back to the worst of it. We're about to do the opposite over here, I fully believe, which is we're going to kick out this sort of right-wing government we've had for 14 years now. Mm. And there's a big reckoning coming, and there will be an immense political sort of readjustment. And so from that point of view, I feel very sort of privileged to be able to sort of have a ringside seat at this and see how it sort of, you know, goes down. But I think if we have this conversation this time next year, Beth, you know, there will be regrets, there'll be issues about going on, but it'll be a very different country here. It'll be a new government, and there will be a sort of renewal, I think, of some hope and some positivity rather than this sort of pragmatism and cynicism that seems to rule. It comes largely from a right-wing press, I've got to say. You know, the right-wing media has fueled this to a huge extent. Mm-hmm. But I think they're realising that that's it. They've run out of road, and there will be other things that will come in. People have seen through a lot of what they're doing. And I said I wouldn't read another poem, but I'm going to read just one last one because I wrote this for my son. And so this poem's called "This Is an Incitement." Don't settle into inertia as the ash falls on your head and shoulders, soft and ankle deep at your feet. Take up your pens and brushes and make art. The ancient dragons of greed coiled tight around their hordes don't understand art. But the snake oil minions who whisper in their ears as they sleep, they fear it. Art can capture the souls they bought and paid for. If you want to slay dragons, make art.
That was lovely. Truly, I loved the very evocative dragon metaphor. I thought that was really interesting.
Yes, and it's Nick's use to draw a dragon, Beth. What can I tell you?
Exactly.
Sometimes that's the strongest motive. My current book, I'm writing and illustrating at the moment. I won't be writing anymore. I think I've come to the end of that particular bit of road. It's for, you know, my 8-year-old readers. It's called A Mermaid's Diary because I want to draw mermaids. I don't apologise. That's what I'm doing at the moment. Serious, in-depth mermaid research. And I'm having so much fun. It's ridiculous.
I just wanted to continue on that thought, actually, Blee, and just ask you about what the experience is like of sketching for children's books. And is there a certain perspective you adopt? Like we spoke earlier about, you know, those memories of childhood being very vague. But when you see the children walking past, you know, you sort of maybe identify with them in a way, or sort of it brings you back to that state, perhaps.
I think the idea of working for children, I mean, one always, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but I write for my younger self always. So those are the enthusiasms. Those are the things that sort of, you know, motivate me. But at the same time, I'm also writing for my children. So some of the books I've written are with my daughter in mind. because I just thought, I want the sort of story that my daughter would respond to, that's not about sort of pink princesses and sparkly things, about sort of something with, you know, a main character with attitude and not obviously polemic, but sort of, you know, role model that I want her to have. So that's motivated me. So I wrote sort of these fantasy-based things because I knew they would love them. And then they engaged with me and we would go for long walks and they would come up with plot lines and say, Dad, what about this and that within the worlds I created? So that's the sort of immersive part of it. But equally, when I write, I always go back to memories of myself as a reader, you know, the things that I responded to. And so what I'm going to be writing next, after I finish this current book, is I'm going to write something I'm called The Great Enormous Book That Makes No Sense and No One's Asked For, working title. And I'm going to write the book that I would have wanted to read when I was 15. And it's going to be like nothing around, because quite frankly, I was a very odd 15-year-old with very specific interests. And it's going to be a bit Ursula Le Guin, it's going to be a bit Tolkien, it's going to be a bit, you know, some of the stuff that I loved at that age. And I'm going to write it for myself. But it is that, it's reconnecting. Because at the end of the day, you know, why am I doing this? Well, I'm sort of doing it for myself. And then the connections you make are the burn, where someone comes to you and says, that song you wrote, it meant something to me. You go, well, that's wonderful, isn't that brilliant? But you didn't write it with that in mind, did you? Yeah. You wrote it because it's your experience.
Indeed.
So we all have that as creative artists. I think we channel our sensibilities, the things we love, the things that touch us, the things that sort of motivate us into our work and hope that it has resonance. But quite frankly, Beth, if it doesn't have any resonance at all, I would still do it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think with authenticity comes, you know, relatability, but also one shouldn't try to be relatable or sacrifice.
Can you do that? I wonder. You know, something in me just, I can't do it. Sometimes my wife would come into the studio and I'd be giggling and she'd be saying, you're laughing at your own jokes again. And I'd say, so, you know, I'm not proud of that, but yes, because there are things that I find amusing and I want to put in my books. Mm. And if someone enjoys them as well, that's fantastic. Mm. And if that, I can't do it with that in mind. I can only do it with this other imaginative idea. As I say, I'm writing for my younger self.
If the world around you inspires your art, do you think your art in turn informs that world by impressing upon you?
I don't know, Beth. I mean, it's a really good philosophical question. I don't think I have any interest in posterity. I don't care, you know, in a sense. I won't be around for it. So that's not... I don't know. I can only speak as someone who has read things that have profoundly affected me and given me a perspective on stuff. And again, we can't, because that would be absurd. You know, it's sitting around trying to come up with the most devastating things we can imagine. But I would like to think actually that that's part of what one does creatively. If you make something, it might find someone at a certain point and be a sort of inspiration to them. That's tremendous. So some of the sort of things I enjoy most is when I sort of meet younger sort of creative people who are working on projects. And I'm thinking, actually, I experienced that when I was a young artist and someone came along who had far more experience than me and said something kind or encouraging or, you know, was interested in something I was doing, I would just float off on a wonderful sort of feeling of elation. We can pass that on. So it is this passing on, I think, which I think in the creative world can be very powerful.
That was illustrator and author of children's book and political cartoonist for The Observer, Chris Riddell, chatting to Beth about his new volumes of poems as well as creative processes in art making.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.